Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
On a cool fall afternoon in 1969, a red and white armored car pulled to a stop in Brooklyn. One after the next, each of the three guards stepped out from the truck and walked into a nearby deli to grab lunch. Returning to the truck, two of the guards sat eating while surrounded by bags of cash from the Aqueduct racetrack, totaling more than $2 million. After their meal, they were set to deposit the money on Wall Street, but their day was about to experience a dramatic shift. As the final guard returned to the truck, three armed men grabbed him and forced their way inside. Securing the guards' weapons and cuffing them together, the assailants put money bags over their heads and drove a few blocks down to a waiting car. In less than 5 minutes, the three men made off with over $1 million and vanished just seconds before police arrived on the scene. Investigators tried to pin the crime to a number of different suspects, including a ring of corrupt cops, a pair of bank robbers, and even members of the Gambino crime family. Now, more than 50 years later, what was once the second largest cash robbery in American history is all but forgotten. And while others have been solved, this brazen daylight robbery remains a complete mystery. Was this truly a random crime planned and executed by common crooks? Or did someone with inside knowledge pull off one of New York's largest unsolved heists? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 172, The Aqueduct Wells Fargo Robbery. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we examine one of the largest unsolved heists in New York history. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Lately, we've dug into some really intense and heavy cases. I thought maybe it would be good to take a week to focus on a crime with less blood, less violence, and a lot less heartbreak. A lot of people have been asking me to do another heist episode, and it seemed like this would be the perfect time. This is episode 172, The Aqueduct Wells Fargo Robbery. For most people, life was moving on with the steady cadence it had always kept rhythm with. But the world was in the midst of a dramatic shift, as less than 50 days remained before the 1960s passed into memory and the 1970s began. The Fifth Dimension dominated radio stations, Wedding Bell Blues knocking Elvis out of the number one spot, as the Beatles Come Together continued rising, even as the band itself was falling apart. More than 400,000 attended Woodstock to celebrate peace and music just days after the grisly Tate-LaBianca murders rocked a West Coast already haunted by a monster known as the Zodiac. 6 years had passed since John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, but his promise of a man on the moon had been fulfilled. Better late than never. The Vietnam War raged on, under the administration of new President Richard Nixon, and the Mets shocked sports fans around the country, winning the World Series and passing, amazingly, into legend. As the crisp chill of fall closed its grip on the Northeast, New Yorkers wrapped their coats a little tighter and moved down the long avenues with a hastened pace. The steady rise of the morning sun could do little to fight back the growing cool as brisk breezes sailed down the streets, with hints of winter's bitter cold nipping at gloved hands and necks draped in knitted scarves. Headlights flipped on as many began their commute before the stars faded from the sky, while others clustered together in the warmth of subway stations awaiting their express transit to another day on the job. Others stayed behind, waking up to pull back the shades and watch as morning light singed the edges of yellowing leaves drifting haplessly towards the cold asphalt. As morning transitioned towards afternoon, the soft din of night in the city was replaced with the familiar cacophony of car engines, honking horns, and millions of footsteps reverberating off the pavement. A stone's throw away, just across the East River, the residents of Brooklyn awoke to a similar concerto as the masses began their race towards work, school, and everything in between, while others watched from windows and fire escape ledges as the world came to life for another busy day. Living in a major metropolitan area, people become accustomed to the unusual. What might seem out of place to visitors is almost ignored by locals, and New York is certainly no different. However, on this particular morning, one woman saw something so out of the ordinary that she just had to pay attention. An armored car sat parked at an angle in the middle of the road, the front bumper inches away from the curb, its rear blocking any traffic that attempted to maneuver down the busy street. Curious, the woman walked closer to her window to get a better look, and that's when she saw them. Three men, too far away to get a good look at, were standing at the rear of the armored car whose doors hung open. In rapid succession, the men began transferring thick, overstuffed bags from the armored car into a gold-colored convertible parked just a few feet away. The woman, thinking this was extremely strange, noticed that none of the men were wearing uniforms, and then she knew something was wrong. Dialing 911, the woman began describing the scene to the dispatcher, who assured her units were en route. Just then, one of the three men slammed the doors of the armored car shut before climbing into the convertible seconds before it raced down the street. Finally, from that angle, the caller was able to get a look at the convertible's license plate, and while units were being sent to the location of the armored car, roadblocks were being set up at the bridges and tunnels. Deputy Inspector Thomas Gleason, commander of the 12th District, arrived on the scene along with 12 units surrounding the armored car. As they approached, they could hear the muffled calls for help from inside, but with the doors being locked, they had no way of gaining entry. Calling in, the inspector asked what had happened, to which one guard replied, "We've been robbed." At approximately 6:45 in the morning on Wednesday, November 12th, 1969, 35-year-old Thomas Raftery left his Crescent Street apartment in Brooklyn. His commute wasn't the longest one, though traffic often made it take far longer than necessary. Raftery had been employed by Wells Fargo for 9 years and had already risen up to the position of crew chief. According to Wells Fargo's policy regarding armored cars, each day employees would arrive at a main hub where they would be assigned that day's route. The routes and crews were changed daily, and while many of the employees had come to know each other from working together on various routes, no employee knew which truck, route, or crew they would be assigned to prior to receiving their orders for the day. Arriving at the hub, Raftery entered the building and proceeded to the employee locker room where he'd change into his uniform, holster his revolver, and strap on a bulletproof vest. Raftery pulled his time card out from a sleeve hanging near the clock and inserted it beneath the stamp which punched in the time as being 7:45 a.m., the beginning of his shift. Upon receiving his assignment for the day, Raftery would be joined by two other guards. Barry Cateridge, 25 at the time, had been assigned to ride shotgun beside the driver, 50-year-old James Carrigan. Catteridge was new to the job, having joined Wells Fargo just a year earlier, while Carrigan was a 30-year veteran who had been hired on by the company in 1939 when he was 20 years old. A normal day's work wasn't highly complicated. Crews would be given a list of locations they were set to make pickups from, and following that pickup, they'd head over to different financial institutions to deposit funds collected from the stops. While the work itself was fairly basic, there was a specific procedure which had to be followed for everything, including what roads were taken. Security officials higher up with the company would scout out routes, making note of traffic patterns and any security dangers in order to determine what path drivers should take to reduce risk. Of course, Raftery's crew would be driving through Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan, where there really was no escape from a lot of bumper-to-bumper traffic and frequent instances of gridlock. That Wednesday morning, though, began without issue. The crew of three made several stops around Queens, beginning with locations furthest out from their main location and closing in the radius with each subsequent stop. However, in order to limit the amount of money actually being transported, pickups were dropped off before the next pickup began. Their final stop before their lunch break, though, would be the largest pickup of the day. The Aqueduct Racetrack in Ozone Park, Queens, was a tremendously popular betting location, and still is. Even back in 1969, it wasn't uncommon for over $1 million in cash to be collected by the New York Racing Association in a single day. While many businesses had pickups scheduled once or maybe twice a week, the Aqueduct had daily pickups due to the massive volume of money taking in throughout the day. Arriving at the Aqueduct at approximately 11:10 a.m., the three-man crew would have a lot of work to do, not just because of how much money flowed through the racetrack, but also because of what day of the week it was. One day earlier, Tuesday, November 11th, had been Veterans Day, a holiday which sees many federal and state offices close for the holiday, including banks. As a result of the bank closures, the Aqueduct's cash earnings from Monday hadn't yet been picked up and were added to the funds arranged for deposit from Tuesday morning. All told, the three-man crew would be transporting just over $2 million in highly circulated, untraceable bills and coins in 20 thick canvas bags with zipper locks. According to records kept by both Wells Fargo and the Aqueduct, the transfer of money was completed with the three-man crew driving off at 11:33 a.m. The destination for the money was the Morgan Guaranty Company building, located at 23 Wall Street in Lower Manhattan, approximately 20 miles northwest of the Aqueduct, which is on Rockaway Boulevard. Depending on traffic, that drive can take as little as 40 minutes or as long as an hour and a half and beyond. However, on this day, instead of proceeding on to Wall Street, the large red and white Wells Fargo armored car would head northwest out of Queens and into Brooklyn for an unscheduled stop. Driving north, the armored car took Rockaway Boulevard northwest, turning left onto Atlantic Avenue. A right turn took them onto Crescent Street, passing Raftery's apartment, before finally turning left onto Fulton Street. The armored car pulled over to the side of the road near the intersection of Fulton and Pine Streets, where Nielsen's Deli sat on the corner, amid a strip that included different restaurants and a pizzeria. According to employees of the deli, it wasn't uncommon for armored car drivers to stop there for lunch, and on this day, that's exactly what carried Raftery, Catteridge, and Carrigan off their main route. In an article written by journalist Edwin Schrake, he noted that while this stop for lunch was unplanned, it was in fact necessary. All three men on the crew that day were union members belonging to Local 820. As part of their union guidelines, they were required to take a lunch break between 3.5 and 4.5 hours after beginning their shift. With all men having clocked in at 7:45, by the time they left the Aqueduct at 11:33, they were nearly 4 hours into their shifts already. In order for the three men to have lunch, there was a security protocol that had to be followed. Barry Catteridge exited the vehicle first, walking into the deli where he purchased a roast pork sandwich and a cup of soup. Upon returning, he would use a secret coded knock on the back doors, signaling Raftery and Carrigan to let him in. After he had returned to the truck, Carrigan went next, heading to the deli where he too picked up a sandwich. Kerrigan returned, used the secret knock, and was allowed back in. To eat their lunch, Kerrigan and Catteridge sat in the back area of the truck while Raftery was the next to leave. This is where there seems to be somewhat of a discrepancy in the record. Multiple newspapers reported that Raftery went into the deli and, rather than returning to eat his meal in the truck, decided to take a seat inside the deli. However, many other sources have reported that Raftery never actually went to the deli, instead opting to go home for lunch. His apartment was located just one block east of the deli on Crescent Street, and has since been suggested that the entire reason the men stopped at that particular location was so that Raftery could go grab lunch at his own place. While I can't confirm which account is the accurate one, it seems more likely that Raftery would have gone to his apartment, as it likely would have been considered odd by his coworkers if he elected to eat in the deli while they had to spend their lunch crammed into the back of the armored car. At approximately 11:55 a.m., Raftery began approaching the vehicle returning from his lunch break. He had been gone for no more than 10 minutes. According to the Daily News, Catteridge, who was in the back with Kerrigan, spotted the crew chief returning and nudged Kerrigan, saying, quote, "Open up, here comes Raftery," end quote. At the moment that the doors were opened, three men appeared, seemingly out of nowhere. One of the men wrapped his arm around Raftery's neck from behind and placed a snub-nosed .38 pistol at the chief's ear. One of the men then pushed Raftery into the back of the truck, and seeing an opportunity, Kerrigan drew his revolver from its holster. However, before the 50-year-old could level his weapon at the assailants, one aimed directly at him and calmly stated,
"If you want to live to enjoy your pension, drop that thing now."
As Kerrigan weighed the decision, Catteridge waved his hand towards him, saying, quote, "For God's sakes, put it away," end quote. A moment later, one of the suspects pointed his gun directly at Raftery, who was lying on the floor inside of the truck, and firmly demanded,
"Don't make a move, or we'll kill him."
Kerrigan finally acquiesced, lowering his gun. At the time, the guards noted that while two of the gunmen seemed calm and cool, the third was clearly nervous as his gun hand was shaking. Within seconds, two of the men climbed into the armored car and disarmed the guards, while the third hopped into the front, turning the key and starting the engine as the back doors were pulled shut. The two men in the back with the three guards picked up Raftery and took out his handcuffs, securing one end to his wrist and the other end to a steel rail inside the truck. At that time, Catteridge and Kerrigan were dragged over and, utilizing their own cuffs, they were secured to Raftery. After cuffing the men together, the assailants picked up canvas bags used for transporting money and pulled one down over each of the guards' heads. Meanwhile, the driver took the vehicle two blocks west down Fulton before turning onto Chestnut Street. He continued north for another two blocks, bringing the vehicle to a stop between Etna and Ridgewood Avenues amidst a series of brick row houses. The armored car was pulled over at an angle beneath a tree where they had a car waiting for them. After cutting off the engine, the rear doors of the armored car swung open and all three assailants approached the rear bumper. Reaching inside, they began grabbing bags stuffed full of cash, tossing them into the back seat of their getaway car, described at the time as a late 1960s model Chevy convertible. In the midst of emptying the armored car, one of the robbers caught sight of several people in the area who were now watching them intently. Nervous with all of the eyes on them, the man ordered his partners to quickly finish up. After pulling one last bag from the vehicle and leaving 10 behind, one of the men swung the door shut, locking the guards inside. As the robbers climbed into the convertible, a female witness in an apartment across the street dialed 911 to report this odd occurrence. By the time patrol units were dispatched, the convertible was already flying down the road and the top was flipping shut. The entire robbery, from start to finish, had been pulled off in less than 5 minutes. The first patrol unit arrived on Chestnut Street approximately 2 minutes after the thieves had fled, but having a description of the vehicle from witnesses, they were able to send out an all-points bulletin to be on the lookout for the car and its drivers. A second 911 call came in from a nearby resident who reported seeing the vehicle moving west on Atlantic Avenue at a high rate of speed towards downtown Brooklyn. Additional units were dispatched and roadblocks were set at the Battery Tunnel, as well as the Brooklyn, Manhattan, Williamsburg, and Verrazano bridges, in hopes of cutting off a potential escape north into Manhattan or west into New Jersey. Air units were also sent up to scan the roads from the sky in search of the gold-colored convertible with a white top. But somehow, the three robbers managed to evade authorities and disappeared into the massive crush of New York traffic. By the end of the day, the all-points bulletin would be issued all along the entire eastern seaboard. Deputy Inspector Thomas J. Gleason arrived on the scene, and within 10 minutes, there were 12 units blocking off Chestnut Street. As officers approached the armored car, they could hear the cries of the three guards, but they had no way of reaching them. The armored car couldn't be unlocked from the outside without keys, and with the three guards handcuffed inside, they couldn't open it from their side either. All in all, it took approximately 90 minutes for an official from Wells Fargo to arrive at the location and unlock the vehicle. In the meantime, while some officers were left with the armored car, others began the process of canvassing the neighborhood in search of anyone who might have witnessed the crime. As it turned out, they found several people who had seen the incident, either from their apartments or at street level. While police chose not to give an exact number of witnesses, they did specify that the woman who had called 911 was the most helpful. Aside from having witnessed the entire robbery from the second floor, she had also taken the time to jot down the convertible's license plate. Hopeful that this clue might lead them to the identity of one of the thieves, police were frustrated to discover that the car, a 1968 Chevy, had been reported stolen out of the Bronx 2 days earlier. The robbers, having avoided the roadblocks, were increasing the distance between themselves and investigators with each passing minute, but there were a myriad of different possible directions and routes they could have taken. One thing seemed clear to Deputy Inspector Gleason early on. This was no rush job. These guys knew what they were doing, and they had planned it out. He'd later tell the Press and Sun Bulletin, quote, "It was a most professional job. They were very cool," end quote. At approximately 1:30 p.m., an employee of Wells Fargo finally arrived to unlock the truck. At this time, investigators gained entry and quickly uncuffed the three guards, removing the bags from their heads. Each man was then individually questioned about what exactly had occurred that day and for any information they might recall about the robbers. According to their statements, the crime was executed by three white males, believed to be in their 30s. One of the men was described as having lighter skin, while the other two were noted as having darker complexions. Each man was said to stand approximately 5 feet 10 inches tall and weighed between 160 and 170 pounds. At least two of the men were described as being thick and muscular. In terms of their outfits, all that was ever released stated one man wore a tan 3/4 length coat, another wore a similar styled gray coat, and the third wore a blue baseball cap. Suffice it to say, the vagueness of the descriptions wasn't going to make the investigator's job any easier. Examining the vehicle itself, police found that 10 bags of cash had been taken by the thieves, while 10 other bags had been left behind. Initially, it was believed that the assailants had made off with approximately $2 million. However, an accounting of the bags left behind concluded that the thieves had actually made off with $1,377,000, having left behind approximately $700,000. Interestingly, of the 10 bags left by the thieves, 8 of them were heavy and filled with coins, while 2 were stuffed with cash. At the time, police were unsure if they thought they were leaving behind change only, having overlooked the 2 additional bags of cash, or if they'd intentionally left them behind when they'd noticed people were watching them. Had they stayed to take the other 2 bags, they might not have escaped, with police arriving less than 2 minutes after they drove off. At the time, getting away with nearly $1.4 million made this the second largest cash robbery in U.S. history, even surpassing the still unsolved Brinks truck robbery in Boston in 1950. The only theft coming in with a higher total occurred in Plymouth, Massachusetts on August 12, 1962, wherein the robbers had made off with over $1.5 million. Just as an interesting note, adjusted for inflation, $1.3 million in 1969 is the equivalent of more than $10.2 million today. Investigators, specifically Deputy Inspector Gleason, were suspicious of the entire robbery, believing that there had to have been some kind of an inside aspect to it. With the crime having been pulled off as quickly as it had been, with no injuries to the guards and no shots fired, it seemed that whoever had executed the robbery knew what they were doing and exactly where they needed to be. Considering that Wells Fargo sends employees out on different routes with different crews every day, one question quickly became, how exactly did the thieves know that the truck would be stopping on Fulton Street that day? More than 50 years later, and a sufficient answer has never been found. Another interesting detail of the crime came down to what exactly the thieves had done. They had planned it masterfully, that much was clear, but one inconsistency stood out. According to all of the witnesses, not one of the robbers was wearing gloves. This led police to believe they might be able to gather fingerprints from the armored car, though it made little sense that a crew who had planned things out so professionally would forget about something as basic as fingerprints. By the time the sun set on New York, 5 hours had passed, and police were left essentially chasing ghosts. On Thursday, November 13th, both the FBI and state police became involved in the case. When asked why the FBI had joined in, a spokesperson told Newsday, quote, "Whenever we have a robbery of this magnitude, we go in," end quote. At a press conference held by Wells Fargo that morning, a reward of $125,000 was offered for information leading to arrests and convictions. Wells Fargo had put up $25,000, the largest reward they'd ever offered to that time, while their insurance company, Commercial Union, put up $100,000, though this was related more to recovery of the funds. If all of the money was found, the informant would get the full reward. However, if only part of it was found, then the informant would receive a proportional amount. One of the main problems with tracking the money down was that, since it came from the racetrack, it was an assortment of used bills in various denominations. There was no way to actually know which money came from the theft, and therefore, it would be simple for the thieves to put it back into circulation. Charles Gribben, the regional vice president of Wells Fargo, took questions from the media. When asked about the guards stopping for lunch, Gribben explained that the policy allowed them 2 unscheduled stops per day, one to use the restroom and another to have lunch. Gribben stated that they were now reviewing that policy and were considering making changes to it following the robbery. When asked about any disciplinary or legal action to be taken against the 3 guards, if any, Gribben would not comment. In regard to the stolen money, it was all insured. Both Wells Fargo as well as the Aqueduct had insurance policies in place to cover theft or robbery. So in the end, while the thieves had made off with more than $1 million, the Aqueduct itself would take no financial hit from the crime. Deputy Inspector Gleason was also present to answer questions about the crime, even though the investigation was less than 24 hours old. Asked to expand on his statement that the criminals had performed a professional job, Gleason told the Star Gazette, quote, "There were times they could have shot the guards, particularly the one who went for his gun, but they didn't. The bad thing about this Wells Fargo hijacking is that it will excite the cupidity of other stick-up artists. They've been doing jobs that if they hit it big, they'd get $5,000. Now they see how to make $1 million. That's like showing honey to the bee," end quote. While media headlines about the heist reached newspapers from coast to coast, New Yorkers had a very New York response to it, for lack of a better term. While several people interviewed on the street and at the racetrack believed that the thieves should be caught and prosecuted, the vast majority of people admired the robbery, with many noting that the money had come from bets placed at the racetrack and, in a way, they were stealing from the house, not the people. One person, described only as a deli owner, smirked as he told Newsday, quote, "It serves those guards right. They stopped to eat at an ordinary delicatessen. It wasn't a kosher delicatessen. They picked the wrong place to stop," end quote. Just as a quick side note, Patreon listeners will get to hear a lot more quotes in their full context at the conclusion of the episode, just because I found them so ridiculous, I have to put them somewhere. In hopes of tracking the criminals and knowing their propensity for boasting to one another, Undercover police officers were sent to mingle with bettors at the aqueduct, while others began staking out expensive restaurants and stores, looking for anyone who had suddenly come into a large amount of money. Deputy Inspector Gleason explained, quote, "It is a repeated experience of police investigators that eventually, thieves actually do have a parting of the ways and do something that leads to their own downfall, especially where large sums of money are concerned." End quote. There were a lot of rumors, whispers amongst the people, but no specific names given. In fact, Gleason later commented that since residents had viewed this crime more through a lens of humor, most of the tips they'd received came from criminal informants, with very few being reported by regular citizens. Gleason, unable to shake his belief that the crime had some inside aspect to it, arranged for Raftery, Kerrigan, and Cateridge to be questioned and polygraphed. All three men sat through interrogations, and all three passed the lie detector tests with flying colors. Frustrated by the lack of developments, Gleason later stated during an interview with Sports Illustrated, quote, "I still can't totally discount the possibility of an inside job, but at this point, to me, the guards just look stupid. Of course this job was well planned. The crux of the matter is to get inside the truck without getting shot by the guards. That takes a good deal of nerve." End quote. I should note, at the time, Wells Fargo armored car employees were paid $150 a week and were given a $10,000 life insurance policy. Should they be killed while on duty, their families would receive an additional payment of $15,000. It isn't hard to imagine that, given the chance between dying or allowing the thieves to take the cash, most employees are going to go with the latter option. On Sunday, November 16th, 4 days after the robbery, two officers in a patrol unit came upon the getaway car. The vehicle, identified as being a 1968 gold four-door Chevrolet convertible with a white vinyl top, was located in an A&P supermarket parking lot at 11:39 a.m. Despite several days of air searches and the all-points bulletins, the car had evaded authorities until the weekend, and when it was finally located, they were unable to find any witnesses who had seen the car being parked there. The supermarket is located on 183rd Street, approximately 6 miles to the east of where the armored car had been found. Apparently, while investigators tried to lock down their escape from Long Island, the thieves instead had gone deeper inward towards Jamaica, Queens. Upon discovering the car, it was transported to the crime lab in Manhattan, where technicians went over every inch. Knowing that the thieves hadn't worn gloves, it was hoped that fingerprints would be located, and they were. Crime scene technicians lifted fingerprints from both the rearview mirror as well as the front passenger side window. At the time, in the era before every police department had computer systems, the FBI's identification division had access to more than 170 million fingerprint records for comparison, but obviously, no matches were made. No other pieces of evidence were discovered in the vehicle. While finding the car had made investigators hopeful, it became apparent that the answers were just beyond their grasp. In hopes of cracking the case, more than 50 detectives were assigned, with Deputy Inspector Gleason commanding. 2 weeks later, in early December, Deputy Chief Inspector Arthur Grubert was overseeing Gleason's command of the investigation and sat down for an interview with the Daily News. Surprisingly, when asked about progress on the case, Grubert revealed that while the crime had been committed by three men, they were actually looking for several others. Grubert explained, quote, "We are making definite progress. We now know that there were four men in addition to the three actual bandits involved. Several eyewitnesses who saw the stick-up and the dry run have come forward and can identify the thugs." End quote. According to witnesses, just hours before the crime was committed, they saw seven men conducting what I could only refer to as a dress rehearsal. I suppose that makes a previously asked question all the more important. How did these men know that the armored car picking up from the aqueduct would be stopping on Fulton Street that day? Grubert stated that his office was coordinating with both the FBI and the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office and, in hopes of receiving more information, they had set up a special, confidential hotline just for information on this case. Multiple tips came in over the first few weeks the number was active, with the New York police following up on local leads and the FBI tracking interstate tips, Reportedly, their investigation took them as far away as Las Vegas, but no particular tip they received led them to anyone they could directly tie to the robbery. While detectives continued working the case, tips began drying up and the investigation was growing cold. There would be several other robberies and attempted robberies of banks and armored cars in New York, and police tried to link them to this Wells Fargo's heist, but never could. However, in the process, investigators came upon a series of New York City police officers who had allegedly planned and executed multiple stick-ups and robberies. On March 11, 1970, just 5 months after the robbery, a plan to rob another Wells Fargo armored car fell to pieces. Carl Rosen, a petty criminal out of Canada, had been hired on as a driver for the company and was captured attempting to drive away with a truck full of money. This ultimately led to the indictment of NYPD officer Angelo Olivieri. According to the New York Times, Olivieri recruited Rosen, who he'd met in Montreal, and convinced him to get hired on by Wells Fargo, where he masterminded a plan to steal well over $1 million. Everything fell apart, however, due to a slow-moving elevator. When two guards exited the armored car to take the elevator, Rosen tried to start the truck and drive off, which led to the guards chasing him down. Multiple shots were fired. Rosen ultimately dumped the truck and fled on foot and was captured a short time later in Toronto. He was supposed to drive the truck to a nearby van, in which other members of the crew were waiting to unload it. Olivieri, who had taken a vacation day from work, would be in another vehicle with another member of the crew, preparing to fake car trouble in order to block the road behind the armored car so that the transfer could be made. While prosecutors attempted to link this crew to the 1969 robbery, they never managed to. Not only did they find no evidence to connect them, examinations of their financial records showed no indication of where the $1.3 million could have gone. In April of 1970, another robbery took place, though this one focused on a bank. The Fort Hamilton branch of the Community National Bank and Trust Company was robbed of $407,000 in cash, savings bonds, and traveler's checks. It was a complicated scheme which involved assailants arriving at the bank manager's home and holding him and his family hostage the night before. The following morning, one member of the crew was left behind to watch the family, while the rest went with the bank manager. It was clear from the beginning that this had been an inside job, however, as the assailants knew too much about the bank's procedures, including reminding the manager to call and inform Fort Hamilton that he was opening the vault. Ultimately, Joseph John Pompa and Benjamin Briganti were arrested and charged with planning and executing this crime. Both men later pled guilty. At the time, it was noted that they were also considered suspects in the Wells Fargo robbery, but again, no evidence was ever actually found to link them. And while the money taken from the bank was recovered, no trace of the missing aqueduct money has ever turned up. By the time a year had passed, Deputy Inspector Gleason was still working the case, though the 50 detectives he'd originally worked with had all been reassigned, and he was essentially working a cold case on his own. As the years passed, by the mid-1970s, the case had completely fallen out of the press, and even today, it's difficult to find much information about what happened and who may have been involved. Almost everyone who had worked the case has passed away in the 52 years since the crime occurred, and more than five decades have passed, and yet not a single dime of that money has ever been recovered. There were all manner of theories: corrupt police, an inside job, a former employee, and even allegations that the robbery had been planned and executed by high-level members of the Gambino crime family. However, all these years later, the case remains unsolved. On the fall morning of Wednesday, November 12, 1969, three armed men overpowered and took control of three guards in a Wells Fargo armored car. In less than 5 minutes, they disarmed the guards, handcuffed them together, drove to a waiting car, and unloaded more than $1.3 million before driving off into the unknown. While at the time, this was noted as being the second largest cash robbery in American history, there have since been many robberies of greater value. Somewhere, in the midst of the chaos of the 1970s, This case was all but forgotten about. And even today, while the Boston Brinks robbery and the Plymouth mail truck remain popular amongst true crime enthusiasts, there are few who know the story of Thomas Raftery, James Kerrigan, and Barry Catteridge, and the 300 seconds that changed their lives forever. When Simply Safe Home Security's founders, Chad and Eleanor Lawrence, designed their first security system in their kitchen, they did it for a very personal reason. Their friends had just had their home broken into. They were struggling to find a security system that was simple to set up and would make them feel safe again. I've always been security conscious, but considering what I do for a living, I'm even more vigilant than ever. That's why I love Simply Safe. It's so fast and easy to set up, and I can personalize it to fit my own needs. There's no better feeling than lying down at night knowing that me and my family are safe, thanks to Simply Safe. Making people feel safe is what Simply Safe has been doing ever since that moment 15 years ago. A passion to protect people not only drives every engineering detail in its products, but it motivates every interaction with its customers. And the thing is, Simply Safe just makes it so easy. It takes about 2 minutes to customize a system on their website, simplysafe.com/trace. Simply Safe has highly trained security experts ready whenever you need them, whether that's during a fire, a burglary, a medical emergency, or even just when you're setting up the system. There's always someone there who has your back to keep you safe and make sure you feel safe. As my listeners, you can save 20% on your Simply Safe security system and get your first month free when you sign up for interactive monitoring services. Just visit simplysafe.com/trace to customize your system and start protecting your home and family. That's simplysafe.com/trace. This summer, I've been focused in on a few new hobbies to help reset and reinvigorate myself with a little me time. Sometimes the best way to set the board back to one is to give yourself a fun challenge, like learning a new language or picking up a new hobby. Having some more free time to myself this summer, I've got more time to play Best Fiends, the super fun Match 3 mobile puzzle game. Right now, I'm challenging myself to beat 10 levels of Best Fiends every week, which shouldn't be too hard since I can't stop playing. When I first started playing Best Fiends, I thought it would be a great way to kill downtime, waiting on meetings or appointments, and it absolutely was. But soon I found myself wanting to play whenever I had a spare minute. Now I'm level 16-12 and still going strong. Lately, I've been really into Zaha's Cabin, an early access event that allows me to play the adorable little fiend before she's even fully available. It's so much fun. Plus, Best Fiends is free to download, so you can start solving puzzles right away. Summer's a good time to get away from it all, and whether you're unplugging from the internet to hit the reset button, or just finding yourself without Wi-Fi, you can still enjoy Best Fiends. I love that I can play it literally anywhere I want without having to worry about using data or finding Wi-Fi. It's the ultimate escape from the grind. Download the 5-star rated puzzle game Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. The Aqueduct Wells Fargo robbery is one of those cases where so much time has passed and so many bigger heists have been pulled off in the years since that it's pretty much fallen into obscurity. That being said, three robbers still managed to walk away with nearly $1.4 million in less than 5 minutes. And the sheer fact that over all the years that have passed, they've never slipped up and been caught is honestly amazing. If there's one thing we know for sure, it's that people like this talk, and there's always folks out there, be they regular citizens or fellow criminals, who know who they are, or at least have a good idea. I think the mystery of this case is less in what happened, and more in how it was never solved. This has always been one of my pet cases, so to speak. I've collected articles and information about it for years, just out of my own curiosity to know what happened. While the newspapers wrote a ton of articles in the first 2 weeks, they fell off dramatically over the next year. As other robberies were executed and attempted, it seemed like the case had mostly grown cold, and the hope that the thieves would strike again might lead to their arrest never happened. Subsequently, any group who committed or planned a high-level robbery found themselves considered as persons of interest in the 1969 case. None ever matched, though, and the fingerprints recovered from the getaway car never did either. Rather than take this case and break it down through a bunch of different theories, I think it makes the most sense to just go through what evidence we do have and see what makes the most sense. We're basically coming into this like new investigators, handed a cold case file and asked to see what we can put together. Most, if not all, of the witnesses have since passed away. The original investigators have as well, and more than likely the people responsible are either gone or are in their mid-80s to early 90s. Of the three guards, James Kerrigan was 50 years old in 1969, and he has passed away. Raftery and Cateridge, according to my research, are still alive, though my attempts to contact them went unanswered. The biggest question I've had about this case since day one is how the robbers knew that the armored car would be at the deli that afternoon. If Wells Fargo policy was followed, the crew assigned to that route should have been randomized. So even if someone on the inside was working with the thieves, how exactly would they go about ensuring that they were assigned to that vehicle that day? The only way I could see that happening would be as if the person who gave out the assignments was in on it. From what I understand, police investigated everyone working for Wells Fargo pretty thoroughly, and they were never able to make a link between any of the employees and any known person of interest or any criminals. So this makes me wonder. According to employees at that deli, it wasn't uncommon for armored car crews to stop there for lunch. Is it possible that the thieves weren't targeting a specific armored car, but were instead staking out the deli and planning to hit whatever armored car happened to come by that day? Sure, that's a possibility, but I imagine there had to be days where none stopped at the deli, and it seems a little too coincidental that they just happened to get lucky that day by hitting the one carrying more than $2 million. While investigators interrogated and polygraphed the three guards, and they were all cleared, Deputy Inspector Gleason never let go of the possibility that this was an inside job. I tend to agree with him on that. I feel like there had to be someone telling them where to be and how to gain entry to the truck most easily. That being said, the only way I could see this being connected to someone on the inside is if, after assignments were given out, someone made a call and told the robbers what armored car to focus on. It could have been one of the three guards, but it also could have been a coworker. I can't imagine that these people never discussed their routes. Maybe someone complained about having to drive all the way out to the aqueduct. Maybe someone was excited about being in Queens instead of Manhattan. It's hard to say. I also think it's worth pointing out that maybe the aqueduct was the actual target. It wouldn't have been difficult for someone, knowing that they couldn't make deposits on Tuesday due to the holiday, to simply wait around at the racetrack until the armored car showed up. Once the three guards begin their drive, they could simply follow them until they stopped, and this was viewed as an easy opportunity location. The primary problem with that seems to be that much of the thieves' plan specifically revolved around the location on Fulton Street. Witnesses saw upwards of seven men conducting a dry run of the robbery in the hours prior. To me, that says this crew knew the truck would stop at that deli. They placed their getaway car just a few blocks away, and they were just waiting for the truck to show up. Now, a lot of people have cast suspicion on Raftery. He was the last one to leave the truck, he had an apartment around the corner, and he was the one who the robbers used as a hostage to gain entry. Could he have made a call that morning letting the crew know the heist was on schedule? Could he have simply been seen walking towards the truck and the crew was already planning to target whoever the last person out was? Those are both possibilities that can't be ignored. I think it's also worth noting that since Raftery lived so close, it's not out of the question that someone could have seen him going to that deli on breaks in the past, in his uniform, and began asking around. How hard would it be to learn that if he goes there on his work breaks, he probably goes there on his days off too? Living as close as he did, someone in that deli probably knew him on a first-name basis and knew where to find him. So maybe this wasn't so much a situation where Raftery had to have planned the heist. He could have just been used in a way. In the Fort Hamilton bank robbery, they went to the manager's house and held him and his family hostage until the morning when they accompanied him to work, gaining entry to the vault. Someone could have done the same thing to Raftery, perhaps going to his apartment and holding him and his family hostage until the next day. If seven people were involved, but only three pulled off the heist, what exactly were the other four up to that morning? Also, just because seven were seen practicing, that doesn't mean an eighth couldn't have been back at the apartment on Crescent Street. I could see that happening. Basically, the crew tells Raftery, look, we know you stop at that deli sometimes when you're working. What we want you to do is go to work like any normal day, but make sure you stop at the deli for lunch. Instead of going into the deli, walk around the corner to your apartment. Give us a sign that everything's in place, and we'll take it from there. Maybe Raftery gets paid for his trouble, or maybe it's all done in exchange for his and his loved one's safety. I suppose you could wonder why he wouldn't have told police about that if that's the way things were, but I think that depends on who the robbers were. Whether they were part of this group of corrupt cops allegedly pulling off robberies, or perhaps the mafia, I'm sure the opening of his mouth about the plot would have led to a violent response. The possibility of a mafia connection has always been interesting to me as well. The mafia is heavily tied into gambling, so they're likely going to have connections and contacts at the aqueduct. They're going to have a pretty good idea of how much money is moving in and out of there on a daily basis. People with gambling problems often find their way into mafia situations, be it through card games and betting, or maybe borrowing money to pay off outstanding debts. Also, the lack of violence makes me feel like this wasn't a crime pulled off by common street thieves, but people who knew how to keep their cool under pressure. While I'm certainly not implying a link, one name that I can't help but think of is Jimmy Burke. Known as Jimmy the Gent, Burke was a member of the Lucchese crime family and a prominent figure in the 1978 Lufthansa heist, which netted over $5 million and was executed after a holiday. Jimmy earned the title of the Gent in part because oftentimes during robberies he committed, usually targeting truckers, he treated them well and sometimes even gave them cash to keep their mouths shut. It was also supposed to be kind of a sarcastic nickname. He and his crew were able to get in with truck drivers who would inform them about high-dollar merchandise being transported and how to get to it. Again, not saying Burke was involved, but there is an air of mafia around this crime. To say the job was professionally done is an understatement. Three guys versus three armed guards, and they managed to do it all in less than 5 minutes without a shot fired or a punch thrown. That takes guts, a calm demeanor, and a lot of planning. Yet, there are details that contradict this well-planned-out idea. Firstly, we've got the one robber whose hand was shaking. Surely you could look at that like this was his first time or he was really nervous. However, I know from personal experience, when my adrenaline gets going, my hands tend to shake. It's not related to fear so much as it's my body's natural response to intense situations. My mind works calmly, my thoughts move smoothly, but my hands shake. Let's face it, if you plan this out so thoroughly, you're not bringing along the guy who gets nervous really easily. If he was part of that trio, he must have known what he was doing. At the same time, why did none of them wear gloves? This is a detail which has stood out to me for years, and there's something about it that really bothers me, but I can't quite put my finger on it. It's almost like they knew their prints weren't on file, so they didn't have to worry. Now, assuming they were mafia guys, the only way their prints aren't going to be recorded is if they somehow manage to never get arrested. That's not impossible, but if you're high enough up to be pulling something like this off, it's difficult to imagine you've never gotten hauled in on some charge. It's not like fingerprints were an unknown in 69. They were a basic cornerstone of investigations, so anyone heavily involved in criminal enterprise is going to know better. The same applies to the ring of alleged corrupt cops. I haven't been able to find exact dates, but it seems like the NYPD hadn't fully launched their program of fingerprinting police officers yet. So maybe, if indeed some cops were involved, they weren't too worried because their prints weren't on record. At the same time, they'd have to have known that if there was any suspicion about them, they'd be asked to submit their prints for comparison, so why not just take the extra minute or two to put on some gloves? They went through the trouble of stealing a getaway car so it wasn't connected to any of them. They practiced the crime hours before they executed it. They had an escape route and a plan in place, but just didn't think gloves were worth using? That'll always bother me. It was a cool day out, too. No one would have thought it odd to see guys walking around wearing gloves, and yet they just didn't. In the end, there's a lot of different things to consider here. You couldn't track the money, being bills of all different denominations that had been in and out of circulation. You'd never know if that bill you were holding came from the heist or anywhere else. You couldn't track the car because it had been stolen from the Bronx 2 days earlier. Although, maybe because it had been stolen from that area, you might be looking for someone who lived in or spent a lot of time in the Bronx. You've got fingerprints, but they never match to anyone, so trying to narrow a suspect off them, especially in an age before computer systems connected law enforcement around the country, would have been a very time-consuming process with no promise of an answer. If these guys were mafia-connected in 1969, you're not going to find many New Yorkers who are willing to give their names up. It was a different world back then, and the mafia, while corrupt and violent, had a certain level of respect and street credibility that made people know better than to try and turn someone connected into the police. Mafia guys back then took the oath of omerta very seriously, and in the days before RICO cases, mob guys tended to keep their mouths shut. They'd do some time rather than risking everything to save themselves. If you're looking at a ring of corrupt cops, they'd likely have known to keep their mouths shut as well. Sure, someone could have spoken up and turned someone else in, but to do so would result in everyone associated with the crime targeting that person as an enemy who needs to be silenced. Cops have connections to prisons. They have a rapport with criminals on the street who double as informants. It wouldn't be very easy to escape their grasp back in the 1960s. I think the biggest mystery about this case comes down to where the money went. Splitting $1,377,000 seven ways would result in each member of the heist receiving just under $200,000, which in today's money would be $1.4 million apiece. Now, if that cash was only split between the three who executed the crime, then they'd each be taking home $459,000 or $3.4 million today. I find it difficult to believe someone working a regular job in New York, be it as a cop, for Wells Fargo, or anything else, would have an easy time hiding that much money without anyone noticing. In the Fort Hamilton bank robbery, they got caught because one of them requested the largest safety deposit box a bank had, and employees notified authorities. Yet, when three guys walked off with $1.4 million from Wells Fargo, it never showed up anywhere. So what do you think? Was this a case where it was an inside job? Was the mafia somehow connected to it all? Was it really just a group of guys who planned and executed this nearly flawless robbery without ever getting arrested before or after? I also think it's worth noting that back in 1969, if you were going to rip off that much money, the mafia, if they weren't already involved, was going to be out looking for you to collect some tax on that money. While it may seem like a far-fetched idea, I've also often wondered if maybe while the robbery was targeting the armored car, there might have been an insurance angle to it as well. You steal over $1 million, which the aqueduct is going to get back from their insurance carrier. Now you've doubled your money and in the end, no one is the worse for it. The aqueduct keeps taking bets, the insurance company pays out, and now you've got twice as much money to play with. Unfortunately, in this case, we're likely never going to know. 52 years ago, three men pulled off one of the largest heists in American history to that time. In a span of less than 5 minutes, they robbed $1,377,000 from a Wells Fargo armored car in broad daylight on a busy Brooklyn street. Despite witnesses seeing the robbery and calling police, none of the criminals involved were ever identified, and whether they continued to live in New York or moved out of the state to live the rich life elsewhere, it seems apparent their identities are unlikely to ever be discovered. Unless those prints are entered into the system and finally kick back a match, someone speaks out after more than half a century, or maybe a new investigation finally manages to break the case, the Aqueduct Wells Fargo robbery will remain open, unsolved, and very cold.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
If you're looking for more information about the Aqueduct Wells Fargo armored car robbery, there are some archive newspapers that have information on the case. Specifically, the New York Daily News and Newsday had the most articles. If you have any information about the Aqueduct Wells Fargo armored car robbery, please contact New York Crime Stoppers at 1-800-577-TIPS. That's 1-800-577-8477. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod. Message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod. Email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com or comment in the Facebook group. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Ann Bertram, Aurora K, Bacon Bits the Cat, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Dave Allen, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eric Sumpter, Guillerme Pinto, Heather Louise, James, Jen Treb, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kara Moreland, Marla Wright, Melissa Brakeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Orange Patches, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levonen, Sarah Mascaratolo, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, Tracy Woods, and Walter Jansen. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That's going to conclude this week's episode. If you haven't already, please consider rating the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. 5 stars would be greatly appreciated, but it's up to you. Share these episodes, spread the word, and maybe together we can help bring justice to those who have been deprived of it. I hope you didn't mind this week's break from some of the heavier and more difficult cases. I think we all need to take some time once in a while to focus on something a little less grisly and heartbreaking, and that 100% applies to me as well. So thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.